Hi, my name's Dave Farley, and welcome to the Engineering Room podcast, where we seek out influential and interesting people from the world of software. Some of the world's best developers and thinkers to pick their brains to discuss their ideas, and occasionally to challenge my own on what it takes for all of us to make better software faster. The Engineering Room series is sponsored by Equal Experts, and I'd like to thank them for their ongoing support. So if you'd like some help building some great software, or are interested in finding a great place to work, do check out their links in the description below. My guest today has a fascinating story to tell. Many people that I talk to about continuous delivery have reasons why it's impossible for them to adopt it. A hardware component to their project, legacy code, regulated industries, safety critical systems, and so on. But all of those reasons are wrong. I've seen projects like all of these adopt continuous delivery very successfully. CD works great for projects like these. I'm sure that continuous delivery is generic and works for any kind of software development. But though I have written a few games and have even written games with test-driven development and continuous delivery, I've never written a modern AAA game. And so I was delighted when I came across people who had. My guest today has been a key player in teams that pioneered the use of continuous delivery in games, working on Microsoft's Sea of Thieves project, starting with continuous delivery from the very beginning, and later introducing continuous delivery to Minecraft, which by then had several years of legacy before they started on that change. My guest is an experienced software engineering leader and manager in the games industry, games programmer, and test automation expert, with a particular focus on gameplay, tools, and automation. These days, he works as a consultant advising games companies and teams on the adoption of test automation and continuous delivery. He's also helped some of the biggest live service games in the world to restructure their development processes to ship updates safely, cost-effectively, and much more frequently. He's focused on improving developer experience and on the sustainable delivery of high-quality software through continuous delivery. He's also a speaker at the Game Developer Conference. He's worked for some of the leading games companies in the world. He's an expert on automated testing for games and a continuous delivery practitioner in a challenging domain. Please welcome Henry Goldie.
Thanks, Dave. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming, Henry. It's a delight to talk to you. I was really blown away the first time I came across the story of Sea of Thieves, where I think you innovated some of these practices in games development. So what triggered your interest in finding different ways of working in games?
Well, I started out my career in games as a gameplay programmer, so implementing gameplay features, and worked on a few titles, and had expected to keep doing that. But for roundabout reasons, I found myself in an ESTET, software engineering test role at Rare, the studio that developed Sea of Thieves. I ended up really appreciating having the opportunity to kind of help an audience that I really care about, which is developers. And also, once I started in that role, I kind of came into it as like, well, I know nothing about this, so I better start reading. Came across, TDD, all other kind of, testing related topics, and just found that there was kind of a fascinating world there that I had just been completely blind to. And also realized that I had, as a gameplay programmer, been throwing my stuff over the wall to a huge manual test team with really no conception of like, did it really truly work? So it really was a revelation to me that those quality practices existed that could help me be a better programmer and be less wasteful, catch things further upstream.
Yeah, the idea of throwing the change over the wall and not thinking about it, I think that's maybe not obvious to people that haven't worked this way before, but that's actually one of the big wins, because it feels like throwing things over the wall and letting somebody else worry about it is the win, but actually it's the other way around, because we're optimizing to increase our own feedback and confidence in the work that we're doing, and that seems like a liberating change to me.
Right. And especially in a complex system like a game, when you make a mistake at a low level and you're then trying to find it at the very high level, there's like many layers of complexity that has to travel through to show up there. And then you have to go through a whole like reproducing step, if you can reproduce it, and then debug it. And it's just so much simpler if, you know, like if I'm writing serialization code, you know, if I can just write that TDD and just know that it works.
And that ability to kind of, you know, focus your attention on the right places to look when something's going wrong, I think is one of those huge benefits to adopting this way of working. So what do you see as the particular challenges for adopting continuous delivery and automated testing in games?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. And there's like the facetious answer, which is that like, there aren't really any that don't exist in other domains to a greater or lesser degree. But I do think that there is a genuine case for games being, you know, especially tricky for a number of reasons. And, you know, and we can kind of dive into a number, like I have a list of notes. There are a number of them. But I think like fundamentally, I would kind of boil it down to, you don't really know what you're making up front. Is kind of maybe a difference. Again, not so much of a difference. Like there are in many other domains, you know, we tend to imagine that, you know, people are just like, well, I know what business software to write. It's like, well, no, if that was the case, then there wouldn't be agile practices that exist to mitigate that. But yeah, all of those problems that are found in the other domains, we tend to just have like many of them. So that kind of conspires to consume the attention and resources of the team in such a way that it seems then like a luxury to try and invest in these kind of practices like this delivery. And I think there's also such a wide range of types of games that are made, all the way from, you know, one or two people working on an indie title up to, you know, thousands of people spread across the globe working on a thing, right? And so of course you're going to need to adjust the intensity and discipline of how you develop software based on those constraints. And so if you are in that one or two people, I still think there's benefit to be had. And I've seen actually a couple of examples. Andrew Frey did a talk about the testing on Rollerdrome, which is kind of a smaller title, and really did a great job, I think, explaining how even on that small scale, you can get massive benefits from having kind of a very targeted safety net. Broadly, he had just kind of put in place kind of high-level validation that certain core things worked that could be then, you know, run across all of the, say, characters that are in the game, rather than doing a lot of very custom test writing. So for like a few hours of test writing, they got a ton of value. And then also targeting their most complicated system, which was their character movement. So it's a game where kind of you're on roller skates and you go up and down ramps and things and spin around and shoot. And by doing that, he said they were basically able to move from having sort of a 2-week code lockdown before milestones to being able to, like, they made a very fundamental change to the physics system right before release.
And that kind of feedback on the fundamentals, I suppose. So it's not, you certainly want to apply these kinds of techniques as broadly as you can in the scope of your problem. But I don't know, I'm making an assumption here, but certainly my limited experience of using TDD for writing simple single player games, which I've done for fun and rather as an intellectual exercise rather than anything else. But doing that, it seems to me that the separation that I've been making is between the functioning of the code and the gameplay. The gameplay, I'm reasonably happy to be interactive and playing it to see what the feedback is. I'm not going to write an automated test to say, you know, is this fun to play? That's a different kind of more subjective, more human kind of evaluation, it seems to me. And I think that people often get hung up with that kind of stuff when thinking about this. But if we can do away with the drudgery of just saying, have I broken anything while I was trying to play, you know, make this more effective and keeping the gameplay fun. Would you agree with that kind of separation?
Yeah, definitely. And I think like if you haven't worked in that environment where you have a safety net of tests like that, it's really hard to imagine what it would be like to just be able to kind of safely make changes. You know, like it's very common in games, you know, you'll find like those, you know, several thousand line functions that no one dares touch because it works right now, you know? But I think there's, I guess, another kind of challenge in games specifically, and I imagine in other domains too, is that relationship between like development and QA. Historically, and to a greater or lesser degree, there is a large stigma around, you know, being in QA. Not the same everywhere, of course, but there are definitely companies that really treat their QA people as sort of, you know, less than. So that then stigma kind of affects the these people have a lot of great knowledge and information about what needs to get tested that could be really helpful to programmers who want to write tests. Where I've seen it work really well is where that kind of silo can be bridged and those folks can work together. And, you know, like things like Three Amigos from the BBA.
Yeah, 100%. My own preference in sort of team organization, certainly in larger, more complicated projects, is to have professional test people, not to do all of the testing or to write all of the tests or to own all of the testing or to own the responsibility for quality, really, but to bring that different perspective of thinking about how we evaluate and how we, you know, grow the quality of our systems more effectively as part of the development team, working very closely, very collaboratively with developers. I think that developers should be owning responsibility for the testing themselves, because it seems to me that it works best when it's a fundamental part of the development process, which I know you've spoken about and written about a little.
Yeah, and you know, you're talking about you know, not writing tests for is this fun, and that's absolutely right. You know, that's the last thing you would try and write a test for, right? I think the anti-pattern that we see a lot with games is that we leverage humans as computers. I remember at Rare we talked a lot about that that line in one of Jez Humble's talks where he says, like, you know, when you have humans do stuff computers could do, then all the computers get together at night and laugh at us. Which just, it would just seem so apt, but still it's very prevalent. And there's a few kind of structural reasons and historical reasons. Often folks who are on the QA side maybe don't come from a technical background, so it can be harder to kind of bridge that gap. And then it, you know, adds to that whole kind of lack of understanding and empathy. I was going to say, I think that maybe as a result of that, when first approaching automation, what normally happens is that it's either driven by QA or driven by, you know, some kind of senior leaders or in engineering or kind of grassroots. But in all cases, it's typically the first thing people try and do is automate a manual test. Which is like the least useful thing you can do. Because however well you automate it, there's so much implicit asserting going on as a human is experiencing a product. Like they can tell if it's fun or if it looks right or feels good. So I think it's almost upside down the way that we typically approach it. And what I much prefer to see is like starting with the components. You know, so if I'm making a game experience, do I want to be doing that with components that I don't really trust that they work, and then try to figure something out like why it's broken? Or do I want super solid, robust components? And the various components involved, you know, have different degrees of, I guess, appropriateness for, you know, how much discipline you apply.
So is that the way that you would see, is that the best approach that that you see in terms of getting teams to start adopting the automated testing mindset? You start with the finer grained unit testing level stuff, presumably, in terms of the behaviors of the system, or are you talking about something else?
Yes, I think there is kind of like a step zero, which is to get kind of very coarse-grained end-to-end tests. Just, you know, can we boot into a level, like that kind of thing? Because that adds the value of, you know, if I'm going to take a build and, you know, overnight deploy it onto 200 dev kits in Poland for people to test the next day, like, are they going to have a wasted day? So there's that kind of initial value. I think from a developer's perspective, I think it's much easier to offer them the tools to start with low-level testing. And really, I guess just, you know, tools that let you write tests at the level of whatever it is that you're writing. So if you're writing something that can be unit tested, that's great. If not, then maybe we can give you a framework that enables you to test that.
So the barriers to that that I normally run into when I'm trying to help teams adopt automated testing are kind of cultural, in the sense that there's certainly you mentioned before, people kind of look down on the people that are responsible for testers. So often developers don't think it's their job to test the software. And, you know, that's for something else. That's a more menial task that somebody else will do, which is completely wrong, but mm-hmm. people hold that viewpoint. Yeah. So
and that's self-defeating as well, right? Because if you ask someone else to do it, do I really want to wait 2 weeks for something to be found and then a bug to come back and get assigned to me and now I have to context switch?
And you know, the evidence is pretty clear that, you know, you're going to get an awful lot fewer defects and you're going to be working much more quickly overall if you can get that much shorter feedback cycle. And that's, you know, really what we talk about all the time on this channel. But the other barrier is a more technical one, is that this, you know, if we're retrofitting this to pre-existing code base, the code base is the wrong shape to make that work. And I know you had this problem in the Minecraft code base, and presumably with clients since then. What's your approach to solving that part of the problem?
Yeah, definitely. So, like, I kind of think of that as like the architectural constraint, which affects basically every game engine that's out there, because they've been developed without the constraint of being testable, and so therefore they're not testable. To the cultural point, I think there is that. There's also maybe in that cultural bucket, I hear a lot, I don't have time. Because it's hard to, especially if you haven't experienced it, right? It's hard to conceptualize, if I make this investment now, then that will pay off for me big time later and we'll move faster overall. It just feels faster if I can just crank stuff out, right? So optimizing for producing potentially broken code very fast versus optimizing for the system producing code that works. But to the architecture question, it is universal and a big barrier to entry. And I think that's often why we maybe start at a very high level. So a typical way to start at a high level is you set up some kind of over the network based, RPC system where you can, you know, poke things on the game and, you know, the game can send you events. And it's often done by technical teams that are kind of owned, quote unquote, by QA, who maybe don't actually have the kind of organizational capital to be even like, quote unquote, allowed in the code base. So they kind of have to be on the edges doing this stuff. And it works fine for a number of things, but and it's important, you know, like one of the things about the test pyramid that I know a lot of people are kind of don't like the test pyramid necessarily, but I think it has some important lessons, which is not that you should slavishly adhere to it, but that, you know, generally you should be focusing on having more things at the lower levels that run faster and are more reliable. And as you go up, they become less reliable and slower. But you still need something at each of those levels.
Yes.
And I think actually on Sea of Thieves, that was a mistake that we made, that we kind of over-indexed on the low level because we didn't know how to do it. And then later we were like, okay, we can always add the higher level stuff later.
Yeah.
I didn't actually answer your question.
No. It's fine. So one of the techniques that I use is approval testing to help to stabilize and allow me the room to refactor safely, in order to get code into a state where it's more testable. Did you do anything like that when you were making these kinds of moves?
Yeah, I like approval testing. We used it extensively in some kind of test harnesses that were outside of the game that we had the ability to control the architecture of. It's often hard because, like, how do you what's the printer for for a game state. And how do you get into that game state? And so typically there's like non-determinism when the game is running, and typically the only context you can do anything is when like the whole game is running. So kind of becomes challenging. So I haven't seen it used well. I guess the closest analog would be screenshot comparisons, which are notoriously hard to make work, again, because of that non-determinism. I love the context, and actually I think that there is scope for like research there to figure out how could we do that. You know, like imagine if you were in your editor, you know, your game editor, and you have kind of those built-in tools where I almost have this idea of like you could kind of like fuzz inputs on one end and then kind of approval test on the other end, just to kind of give you that kind of it behaves the same as it did before. But I've not seen it kind of really applied at scale.
So not for AAA games, but one of my friends, Goiko Adzik, has built some interesting tools, approval testing tools for graphical visual programming. And essentially what he does is under test control, he takes a screen snapshot, and then the test runs and it takes the same screen snapshot and compares the two bit by bit. And then if they differ, he shows the difference, says, which one do you want? And you click on the old one, it does one thing. If you click on the new one, it updates the test so that it's now the new one as the baseline.
So it's
making the human evaluation, that subjective evaluation, but kind of trying to optimize that part of the process, which I think is quite a smart way of doing some of these things. And
yeah,
all of the things that we've talked about, but it's a useful tool in the arsenal.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely. And there's a built-in thing in Unreal that does that. There's, I don't remember if it was on. Yeah, I think it was on CFBs. We had a suite of screenshot tests that were primarily for use by the rendering team. Mm-hmm. But the challenge that I've seen on multiple projects with that is that, again, due to the architecture, it's almost impossible in a large scale game to control the environment sufficiently that you can deterministically generate that screenshot. So there's always some variance. I've seen teams try kind of machine learning based solutions as well. Again, it kind of works sometimes and sometimes doesn't work. So what we had done on Sea of Thieves was we just generated this report where we didn't even try to like do an automatic pass or fail, but we applied like a structural diff metric, and basically ranked them by that. So the ones that were most like quote unquote different would be at the top, and then we would have someone actually look through. When we would generate a build on Team City, it would basically create the diff between that and the last build, which was more for the rendering engineer to kind of look at. And then when someone from QA did that pass periodically, they would pin that build. So we would also generate the diff between that and the last pinned one.
Again, this is one of my things is, if we're going to take a stronger engineering stance on our approach to developing software in general, then part of that requires us to have better control of the variables. So you were saying about the non-determinism of a game. It's kind of is and it isn't inherent in the game, because digital systems aren't non-deterministic fundamentally unless we allow them through concurrency. Mm-hmm. And so if we manage concurrency within the architecture of our systems and the way in which we design the systems, we can kind of narrow that scope. And so, one of the big tools in controlling the variables, going back to what you said earlier, is to narrow the scope of the test so we can put each piece into precisely the state that we're interested in and get predictable results. And that's one of the reasons why it's easier to test on a smaller scale than a bigger scale.
Yeah, and actually someone from Rare did a talk at this year's GDC, which I haven't seen yet because I didn't go. But what I believe it is about is kind of that idea of, trying to go low level on rendering code, because obviously for rendering, you have a bunch of code that lives in the shaders. and but you can't really get at, and you're kind of trying to observe the result of it and infer its yes. behavior through that. So instead, they have a, I believe that they have implemented a system where they do actually, you know, pass data back and forth and effectively have unit tests in the shaders.
So it's, and that is the kind that's in line with the kind of approach that I tend to adopt in general for things. So you know, the way that I would think about it is at those edges of the system where it's difficult to test, my objective is to kind of write a thin layer of code that's reasonably generic, so I can unit test that fairly thoroughly. I can even manually test that or something if I need to, but the idea is to have a piece of, you know, some code that I can largely rely on, in the same way that you rely on Unreal Engine and assume that other people have tested that and so on. You have your own layers of abstraction that are closer to your problem that kind of, again, you know, reduce the variables, I suppose. And
yeah,
I've got a model and you know, and I've got my own abstraction that allows me to render the model within the constraints of this particular game or system. Yeah. And that code that does the rendering is reasonably generic. And that's
I agree.
Design principles, yeah.
I think that arguably maybe that kind of awareness and even skill set isn't quite there, because it's not
Being
common that folks have operated that way. And there's also, you know, when you're talking about layers of abstraction, I'm immediately hearing, you know, people kind of complaining about performance.
Again, they don't need to, because my background is in low latency trading.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
even faster than games.
There are some people who know like much more about C++ than I do who have assured me that, you know, like virtual calls are like not a big deal anymore. I think that's one of those cultural things, I guess. It's almost like a what if, you know, a terrible fear. And honestly, yeah. like it's like kind of goes back to that, like, you know, premature optimization being the root of all evil.
Yeah, and the kind of fear, uncertainty, and doubt that is pervasive in our industry that gets in the way of more people adopting some of these things.
Yeah, but so I agree with the approach that you're suggesting, and in the game development context, it often, you know, compromises are made, you know. So
yeah.
An example, I guess, that comes to mind is I was briefly a gameplay programmer on Minecraft and was implementing the raid system, which is effectively, for those who don't know, it's, you know, you if you acquire a certain status effect and you enter a village, then a raid is triggered and there are waves of enemies that kind of come at you, and each wave you have to kill them all. Until at the end, you get a reward. So effectively, it's a state machine with some stuff that happens. And in order to make some part of it testable, I effectively isolated the state machine part and wrote that TDD and just basically had, you know, like functors passed into it when it was created that let it call out to, you know. So it maintained a list of actor IDs that it thought were still alive, and then each would kind of call out to something else to say, "Hey, did these still exist in the world?" Right. So, because that part I could not unit test because it had so many dependencies, and it was not feasible for me to extract that.
Yeah. So many interesting avenues for us to explore, but that's another one. In that, certainly, my experience of test-driven development and continuous delivery is it changes the design decisions that we make. So we're going to end up designing differently shaped code. I wondered if you saw that in Sea of Thieves. Did Sea of Thieves look different to other games that you've seen that weren't developed in the same way? Internally, in terms of the technical structures?
It's hard to say, honestly. I don't think necessarily significantly so, just because the broad architecture is so determined by the engine that you're building on.
Yeah.
So within that, yes. But I don't recall thinking, gosh, this looks really different.
Yeah.
I mean, in the context of the Minecraft example I just gave with the raids, like that did look different, and I can imagine people looking at that and saying, "Well, why have you done it this way? That's weird, Henry." It's like, well, because I wanted to test this. And the kind of win from that was that there were no bugs in that state machine. And so I gave a talk afterwards that was like, bug-free raids, thanks to unit tests. Just to try. But I think it can look very odd when you have that testability constraint in mind.
Let's move on a little bit. So in one of your videos that I watched describing your experience on Sea of Thieves and Minecraft, you outlined a strategy for changing the development culture. And just to quote you at yourself, you said devs had no experience of writing automated tests. So where do you start? So, and you came up with a little model. So could you describe that to us, your approach to helping to make that kind of move?
Yeah, definitely. And there's kind of like a prerequisite of that they want to. And there's also additional things outside of that model. But I mean, basically, it's kind of the tools that make it easy, and the education to make it possible, and then the ongoing support to kind of help them be successful. Like that formula has worked a couple of times for me.
So again, the stuff that I pulled out from that, the stuff that I copied that you said from that is small team to own the transition. So you're going to talk a little bit about that, the role of those people. What are they doing? I would think of this in team topologies terms as an enabling team.
Yes. Yeah. I think that would be right. I think in kind of both of those cases, we were fortunate to have the resources to have a team like that. And I think, I think a lot about the kind of like platform and developer experience kind of movement, which I think is a similar kind of, empowering and enabling approach. But I mean, the example for me on Minecraft was, as a gameplay programmer on the Minecraft team, I was being asked to write tests for my work. And I had, having been that person who implemented all that stuff on Sea of Thieves, I was highly motivated to do so. But in practice, I was unable to because the test framework was not. It made it extremely hard to write any tests, especially the kind of tests that I would consider valuable. And so when that team got kind of reorganized away, I kind of said, hey, I noticed that there's a problem with the test framework. Could I have a team to go fix that? And they said yes. So I got me and two other folks. And I think to the point of the enabling team, it really helps to have people who are just focused on making that change happen. Specifically not like just going to write a framework. Like I've seen lots of teams where it's like, but we got a team and they wrote a test framework and then no one used it. And I've been that team myself also. So it has to be focused on the goal of adoption of low-level testing by developers as part of their day-to-day work to a degree sufficient to enable continuous delivery. And so with that kind of caveat, I think you made a note in the doc as well of a saying that Phil Baker on the project had, which was, we have to make it easier to write a test than not to write a test. So which at the time I was like, well, that's ridiculous, it's always going to be harder to write a test. But then having seen it, like with the kind of cultural pressure and the available tools that make it easy, and that's just how we work here, I can see it definitely is possible. The step one is, if you're asking someone to do something, you have to make it possible, like possible, and then ideally very easy for them to do that.
That's definitely part of my strategy for helping teams to change, is that you want to make the right thing easy, and you want to make other things possible. So you want to allow freedom for people to innovate and do creative things, but you want to make it easiest to the default, the kind of no think, no, you know, no worry situation to be good. So I really liked the quote about you know, making it easier to write a test than not. That's absolutely what we're striving for.
Yeah, and in the games context, again, kind of going back to specific challenges, I think it is harder because we don't have standardization of tools, you know. So, you know, in some of the language, you know, it's like npm install test framework, then you can start, right? But it's not that easy.
I'm a little bit of a heretic on the topic of tooling. I think that we tend to be a little bit overly dependent on generic tooling, because I think the problems that we face are often easily solved. It's not rocket science. It's not that hard. If you know, most of the tools that we lack, you can write in a day or two, and so often that's better in my experience.
Yeah, I guess I don't disagree. I think maybe in that environment where there are ways where you could easily do that wrong, you know, like you could, for example, write a test framework that you think works well, and it's like, oh, actually, this is running on a different thread than really where people want to do their testing. So that there's some expertise obviously comes into that. It's not necessarily only solvable by standardization of frameworks, but it's just a kind of, at least you have like a starting point. Probably like a well-understood way, right? Like you've done it on other projects before, whereas if you come into it fresh, it's again harder.
Yes. I think that's an absolutely fair pushback. You know, I'm coming at this with a fair amount of experience of doing these sorts of things. It's just, I get involved in lots of conversations about frameworks these days, and some people think of software development almost entirely in the context of the constraints of the framework. And I want the freedom to design things. It's like you were saying that, you know, I've had a quick look at some of the big game engines just through. I used to write a lot of graphics software years and years ago, so I have a passing interest in computer graphics. And so I've looked at some of the game frameworks, and they're very intrusive into your programming model, and the ones that I've looked at. And so there's a degree to which that can be helpful, and there's a degree to which that stops me being able to do the things that I want to do sometimes, like write testable code.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear more actually about that intrusion.
So let's put it into some more concrete terms with technologies that people might be more familiar with. So, you know, so let's talk about, you know, the web frameworks. You know, the web frameworks impose, you know, a specific programming model for writing web APIs. And if you don't abide that by that programming model, it's really, really hard to write code that works. So the things that just kind of map properties into fields on a web page, it's a tiny part of the problem, but you have to work in a certain way, and then you have to go through, you know, more complicated intricacies to be able to add behavior in certain ways if you want to customize some of it.
I see. Okay. So if I'm understanding correctly, then it's kind of when a framework has become mature and it's kind of then evolved like very specifically to match a certain style of programming.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that it's one of the differentiators between a framework and a library or a collection of libraries. A library, you have a design and you use a service from that library. Mm-hmm. A framework tends to always impose some kind of programming model on you and at least put some constraints. If you work within these constraints, I can give you another example from certainly a few years ago now in terms of my use of it. But one of the things that I always hated was the Hibernate framework for object relational mapping in Java, because it inserted its own collections into my code. And I don't want Hibernate's version of the collections in my code when I don't want them. Yeah. Writing low latency code, I'm going to be using my own collections because they're faster, and so it gets in the way of the programming that I need to do to get the job done, but I can't use the framework. So
it's kind of making some choices for you.
So it's removing my freedom of choice to some degree. And as you say, as you correctly push back, it's not always true. Sometimes these things are valuable, but I don't think it's quite as simple a slam dunk a choice of a choice.
I guess for me, like the if I think about, you know, things that impinge on one's freedom to, you know, to design code as you wish in the game space, it's like typically drastically more the engine that's doing that than any test framework. In fact, the test frameworks that we wrote ended up being basically working around the engine, you know. So probably come back to that actor test thing, but the whole point of that is to kind of say, well, gosh, the engine does this, how can we work around that?
And that's kind of precisely my point. So I started off pretty much as a games writer on a very, very small scale, right? Writing very simple, you know, writing the equivalent of Space Invaders and those sorts of things on the first generation of publicly available microcomputers for fun. And, you know, so I did quite a lot of game writing in those days. And one of the things that I liked about game writing in those days is that there weren't many constraints, because largely I was writing stuff in assembler and I could do anything that I needed to or wanted to with the machine, because there was nothing between me and the machine. And that's clearly moved on, and for good reasons, you know, with the power of the modern game engines and so on. But it makes it a different kind of game, and it does reduce the choices
that's not just about
gaming, it's just about programming in general, it seems.
It seems like, you know, game engine framework, whatever it is, you know, when you choose to adopt it, you're making a trade-off between what it gives you versus what you have to give up in order to use it.
And sometimes that trade-off's worth it, sometimes it's not.
It's also kind of irreversible sometimes, isn't it? That's kind of the challenge, is if you don't know up front if it's going to be worth it, and then you do it, and then you're later like, oh no, now it's got its tentacles everywhere.
And one of the ways that I, by design, I tend to work is that by preference, where I can, going back to what we were talking about before, I always prefer to have a little layer of my code between the core of my system, whatever that is, that the game logic, perhaps in terms of a game, and those third party bits that are doing a job for me. I'd like to have a little translation layer so that it's, and that's not always a good thing, as you say, you know, you've got to do that sensitively and so on, but it seems to me that it's not as simple as saying a lot of these problems are not just tooling problems. They are that fundamentally, I think that what we're talking about is that they're design problems. Mm-hmm. And that's a harder barrier. It's a more difficult thing. But one of the things that I value very highly, I'm talking too much, but one of the things that I value very highly is that test-driven development and automated testing helps me to improve my design skills more quickly, in my view. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I guess coming back to that kind of actor tests, I feel like there's maybe a journey, you know, like when I think about teams that are just starting from scratch, like there's always a journey they have to go on. You can't just say, hey, go use this thing, right? Because the culture isn't there, the skills aren't there. There's many barriers. So in the spirit of that journey, and in terms of one of the things I mentioned in my talk was this idea of like first bias for adoption and then kind of scale and optimize, because the adoption is the really hard part. I've seen far more test frameworks that no one uses than the opposite. So with what we saw on Minecraft with the kind of actor test / server test that we can talk about, by making that compromise in order to onboard developers to the idea of writing tests and have them reach that epiphany of like, oh, I wrote a test and it caught a bug, and then become, you know, go on that journey towards being enthusiastic promoters, what we saw over time was, you know, first we saw those kind of tests tick up. And then later we saw unit tests actually overtake those. And I can't prove it, but my theory is that once people became aware of the benefits of testing, they were more willing to actually re-architecture things to be unit testable.
Yes. Yeah. I would imagine that would be the case. Certainly with the sorts of teams that I've worked with, I think that's normally the case. You've got to get. I really liked going back to the talk where, you know, this model that I learned about, your model. I really liked that that idea of biasing for adoption. That's a really, really nice way of saying what we're talking about, really. You know, that is the goal. And I think that quite a lot of this stuff is about, I suppose my definition of pragmatism is, keep your eye on the goal and then you do what's necessary to achieve the goal. And one of the other things that you mentioned is meet the code base where it is. And I think that's one of the things that led you into this actor testing model. So let's talk a little bit about that, because we've touched on it a few times. I thought that was a really nice pragmatic solution to the problem that you were facing. So could you describe the problem a little bit and the solution?
Yeah, definitely. So for those unfamiliar with game engines, typically they will be structured around a world of some kind or a level. And then in that level, you will have actors. And typically those actors will have components on them. And so if you are writing a new component for that actor, you know, I guess I should think of an example. Let's say, I don't know, a pathfinding component, or let's do something simpler. I don't know, even just a component that, you know, signals that the actor is available for some kind of action. So it's really very basic. And I want to write a unit test for the behavior that I implemented on that component, because that's where I'm working. The architecture inhibits that through, typically, if I want to instantiate a component, I will be required to have an actor. If I want to instantiate an actor, I'll be required to have a world. And if I need to instantiate a world, like, I can't, it gets instantiated once as a singleton, or whatever, not as a singleton, but once by some very complex logic in the game startup itself. So there's typically very, very complex architectural inhibitions. You know, you can't go in and mess with those, basically. I have seen someone try and kind of get close, but it just becomes very, very messy. So the idea is that, okay, well, how do I write unit tests for my component then, if I can't get one without having the whole game running? And so the answer is, well, you just let the whole game run. You just kind of say, well, if that's the only way I can get it, then that's how I'll get it, you know. And so you have a minimal world with like nothing in, and spawn an actor through the, like, the real, you know, quote unquote spawning logic that does whatever it does, and then add the component in whatever way that gets added, and then kind of pretend that none of that happened, and then write your unit like test, and then kind of let all the teardown happen. So that's kind of broadly the architectural workaround in order to write things that look like unit tests, but are actually, you know, like, not.
I can come up with a simple example that I saw in another code base, which I must admit I've used as an example to point out other alternative solutions. But there was a test in the Jenkins code base that starts up Jenkins in order to test that if you've got localhost in the URL, it won't start up properly, because it's not supposed to. It's supposed to have a general URL in this particular context. You know, you're starting up the whole system to do some string, to test some string parsing, but it's kind of that kind of model, because the cost of setup in your example is so much more complicated. I suppose that the tricky bit in that is test isolation. So these actor tests, the life cycle of the instance of the game that you're running is specific to that test and only used with that one test, is my assumption.
Typically, no, we would typically,
okay.
You can do that. And I think we had like a debug mode where we could run it that way to kind of isolate failures, you know, if there was something. But yeah, typically, because you just can't afford that, you know, we can't afford to take 5 minutes to spin up the game, or whatever it takes. We would typically like make that trade-off for speed versus accuracy. And then kind of if occasionally we would encounter things where, you know, some test earlier on in the state has polluted the state, and then now something downstream, of course, it's a pain. And we, you know, implemented various ways, like, so like randomizing the order that the tests are run can kind of potentially help find that sooner. But yeah, it's certainly not like an ideal scenario. But what it does do is allow developers to write the kind of tests that we want them to write, and gain experience with the benefits of them.
So what one of the techniques, so that I think thinking of the test isolation problem is an interesting way of approaching that. And one of the strategies that I've seen used very successfully is what something I call functional isolation, where you use natural functions of the application to isolate tests from one another. So every, you know, if you're building a book buying system or something, every test creates a new book and a new account to buy the book. So that there's no leader, there's no sharing of data, or at least you strongly limit the sharing of data as far as you can within the constraints. I imagine that's difficult in a game, but you could.
It's actually fairly easy because you can just like load a new level. Would be the equivalent, I guess.
And
we did do that, but then what you find is that as you kind of going from that biasing for adoption to the scaling piece, then what you find is it takes too long to run all the tests. So then you have to go in and kind of try and reuse that state and just take the hit on the state pollution.
So one of the impacts of that, again, in terms of the impact of testability on design, was that we found that when we were using those techniques, that it made us optimize and make, you know, fast paths to getting some of those core states in place. So one, we kind of first came up with this idea when building a financial exchange. So nearly every test in our financial exchange began by creating a trader or two and creating a marketplace in which to trade the equivalent of your levels in the game. And so we optimized the paths for creating, registering new accounts and creating traders and creating marketplaces so that they would run very quickly as part of to keep our tests fast, which is a weird place to optimize for most systems. But it's one of those impacts of this different way of working, I think.
Yeah. Well, actually, it puts me in mind of not in the testing space, but the process for a game, for an Unreal title, for example, they call it cooking, is where you take the source assets and you convert them into the binary representation that's going to be used. And that, you know, like when we started Sea of Thieves, we talked to another studio that, you know, used Unreal, and they were like, oh, you know, it should be thinking like of eventually being like 48-hour times for that, and we were like, well, that's not going to work because we're trying to do continuous delivery. So actually, some folks who are much smarter than me on the Rare side invested a ton of energy in optimizing that like core engine cook functionality, just because we had to in order to support our goals.
Absolutely. And once again, you know, certainly in my experience, but I would argue that that's a good investment of time and effort. It tends to improve the code in ways that you don't expect.
It improves the
testing. In your approach to trying to make the tests easier to write than not write the tests, did you use domain specific languages to help you to do that?
Kind of. So on the title before Sea of Thieves, which was Connect Sports Rivals, that was when I had read the continuous delivery book and I got super excited about BDD. And so what I ended up implementing was, you know, kind of using this kind of over the network based, you know, remote driving harness, and then with kind of a spec flow layer on top of that. And I thought, well, this is amazing. Everyone will write tests. You know, the testers will write tests who aren't technical. Developers will write tests, and no one wrote any tests except one tester who wrote a bunch of UI tests, and we hired him as a programmer. So that was like a big lesson for me, because like I made that classic mistake of BDD of like treating it as a test authoring style rather than like a way to engage the business. And B, the reality of kind of like my experience on that Minecraft team, you know, where someone was telling me to write tests, but then my reality was like, this is so, you know, like wading through treacle, was I was asking people to, you know, go implement hooks and events in this system they didn't understand, you know, or had never seen before. And then having done that, move to another solution in a language they didn't typically use, C#. Yeah. And then also understand spec flow and implement those, and then write it in the Gherkin language. So it just was so high friction. And so that was like a big influence on the testing for Sea of Thieves. I was like, okay, it has to be in the same environment that people are working in naturally.
Yeah.
But to your question about domain-specific languages, so apart from that, I think... not deliberately, but I think, you know, they emerged. An example might be on the Minecraft test framework. We basically we kind of deliberately architected it poorly, in the sense of we just wanted one single entry point to all of the stuff that people would need. So we just had this one, you know, server test helper class, and then you would basically just, that would have all of your things, like, you know, spawn actor, you know, send this thing, send this event, blah blah blah. And the reason that I didn't want to split it up, it was because I wanted it to be very easy for people to A, discover, and B, add to. And so then over time, we've, you know, people added a whole lot to it, and it's like, okay, well, now we can look at refactoring it. But the goal of it was kind of, I guess, to provide that DSL and the ability for people to add their own, you know, words in that DSL.
So on the, I guess we're getting back to talking about frameworks and tooling again. So I'm a big believer and user of domain-specific languages for automated testing, particularly for the higher levels of testing. Not for all of it, not the lower levels. But also in your programming language. So I my preference by miles is to build my own internal DSL rather than use an external DSL like Cucumber or SpecFlow or something. So for the kinds of reasons that you said, it just feels like too big a transition to move. So I'd have very specialized versions of Java or C++ or Python or whatever the programming language of the project was, you know, for testing, and a DSL that is built on, you know, on top of that programming language, so I can run it in my own testing framework in my IDE as I'm developing the code and run the tests and try stuff out and all of those kinds of things. But the abstraction of being able to create a scenario where you can kind of set things up quickly and easily within the test case, making the test case as easy to write as we possibly can, seems to be, you know, one of the goals in that approach.
And also it puts me in mind of kind of an anti-pattern that I've seen a lot, where people assume that the framework is immutable, you know. And it's like, well, this is our framework, we wrote it, and I really want you to change it, you know. So that, again, that's kind of why I did that, you know, that weird thing that is like a big no-no of making like a grab bag of utilities, because I just wanted it to be really obvious to people. And even then, you know, there was in that support phase, right, there's like, well, at code review time, I'm noticing that you've made, you know, a helper method in your test class here that looks like it could be very useful. Why don't you put that in there? Just encouraging people to feel empowered to build their own test framework, right? Because it is specific to their use case.
Yeah, and you want it to evolve bit by bit as you learn more about the problem that you're solving and your solution to it, and you find those needs. So it's a very organic, natural way of building a DSL, it seems to me. And I've helped teams to adopt the approach quite a few times now, and it seems to work very well. But it is one of those things that seems like a barrier for the reasons that you talked about.
Yeah, and like So to the organic point, like, yeah, I couldn't see a way that we could possibly have like known up front what all the tanks would be. You know, there were a few things that we knew that we seeded it with, you know, like spawning and destroying and whatever, but so just seeding it and then letting it grow.
And it's a fantastic tool for hiding sometimes enormous complexity. So I did some work with Siemens Healthcare a few years ago, and using the functional isolation techniques that we were talking about earlier, nearly every test that they wrote began by creating a hospital because that's where their software was operating. I did some work with a company that was doing genome analysis, and again, you know, you have this easy starter being one line. You could set the starting point based on some test data that was kind of defaulted and so on, but overridable, and just kind of quickly get the test into the shape that you wanted to, again, better control the variables, so we're more likely to get the results repeatable.
Yeah, and it makes me think actually of when I'm writing tests, I will often end up kind of having like a sort of fluent builder that kind of creates the thing that I'm trying to test. I'm thinking about the RAID, right? So I had a thing that was like, you know, RAID builder with this many people with this thing and in this state, blah, blah, build.
Yeah. I think that's a fair analogy. I think they're closely related in terms of approaches. But thinking again, using our design skills, I suppose, to better abstract the problem in ways that makes our life easier as we move forwards. And that really depends on these things being in the ownership of the development team, as you were pointing out, and the responsibility of the development team to grow and maintain.
Right. Yeah, and leverage other people's learnings, right?
Absolutely.
Like the reason that we use engines today rather than build them from scratch is because, you know, they would just we're building on the shoulders of all the learnings that other people have had.
Which gets to another of your kind of headlines in your strategy, which is involve the developers, treating developers of users and allowing them to iterate on solving the problems of test adoption and making it easy for themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I think it seems kind of obvious, but it's often overlooked. I think often there's maybe a kind of pattern where, you know, on the QA side of things, a team is formed and they, you know, they have kind of difficulties connecting, you know, with the developers. They're kind of in this mindset of like, well, they don't like us, we don't like them. And it does go both ways, I've noticed, you know, so from the QA side, that folks will be like, oh, developers treat us really badly, you know, but then also they'll be like, oh, stupid devs did this, you know, it's like, it has to be like empathy from both sides, collaboration. But then, you know, those teams often are kind of junior folks. They're often hired by non-technical people, and maybe don't have a strong skill set in product development. You know, which is really, if you're building a test framework for the purpose of achieving a goal, you know, of having people adopt a certain practice, this really is a product that you're making, you know, and you need to understand your market and when to put things out and iterate and test with the market. So I think that I've seen again and again this pattern of, a team is formed and they think their job is to write a test framework. It's like, that is not your job right now. It's a side effect of your job. You might write a test framework, but you know, your job is to achieve this outcome. So I think it's just often, often I've seen that happen.
Absolutely. I've realized in recent years an awful lot of my, it's a grandiose term, but philosophy of development is about trying to establish and maintain that really strong outcome focus, because it's the goal that matters and how we get there matters less. So everything else are techniques that help us achieve the goal, but it's the goal that's the target, and whatever you need to do to achieve that is ultimately the game. I was just gonna say, for me at least, I think that's really what we mean when we talk about working in an agile way. We're willing to change the way that we're working to suit the conditions.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm a big fan of like kind of core, like lean agile as originally intended, rather than like kind of what people think agile is now. But I guess I also just wanted to caveat what I said about the kind of that product focus. There's also, I'm not trying to blame the people involved, right? Like they find themselves in a system that influences how they behave.
And a lot of what I do as the consultant these days is try to coach organizations to structure themselves to allow the teams the visibility and the ownership to be able to make their own choices. Because that's what works. You compartmentalize it. You try and do it by command and control and micromanagement. It just doesn't work very well.
Yeah, and I it's maybe controversial, but I think it's not unreasonable to say that there might be a difference in teams' ability to be successful in that style with like geographically where they are, So like what I've found is, teams like in the UK and Sweden, say, are often considerably more amenable to that kind of, collaborative, kind of let's work together on a thing than perhaps, North American teams. So I don't know if you've encountered anything like that.
I think there's certainly something about organizational cultural differences, and there's certainly a facet of American organizations that's kind of command and control and bureaucratic, but I think we have enough of that in UK teams and European teams as well. And there's enough creativity, and it seems to me, looking at the teams over the years that I would point to and admire their output, one of the famous really high productivity teams in my early days anyway was Borland, who were famous for the quality of their software and their tools and so on at the time. And that was a small focused team who really engineering led, really focused on their product and the ownership in the development team. And I don't think that changes very much. I think that's nearly all what, when you look, the Macintosh team, that designed and built the Macintosh and all of the software, they were very similar. It's that ownership of the product and that big picture view that you were talking about, the outcome focus.
You think
That's
that maybe
quite a difficult thing to establish. And it's very, very easy. It's quite fragile, so it's very easy to break it with the wrong organizational culture or structure.
Yeah, do you think that it kind of touches, it was related to potentially, organizations that are maybe more engineering led than kind of business led?
I think there are different kind of failure modes in those, and I think I am a technical person, and so probably have a greater affinity with engineering-led organizations. I think that ultimately, what is successful is the kind of partnership that I think that both of us have been talking about throughout our conversation today. Is that you can't, if you look. There's a great presentation from Gregor Hope where he talks about different styles of development, and he kind of so it, one of the things that he characterizes with it is what's the reporting line for software development. So if your reporting line is to the CFO, then you're always seen as a cost center, and they're always trying to, their model is outsourcing and trying to cut costs and all that kind of thing. If it's this The COO, that's a different line of reporting and de delivery. And what you get to in modern high-performing organizations is that your reporting line as the IT function is to the CEO because it's a collaboration. It's you're absolutely front and center a part of the business. I was talking to one of the banks, the senior CTO of one of the banks that was a big adopter of continuous delivery a few years ago, and he said that the CEO said that the next CEO of the bank would be a software engineer because it's that it's that important. It's and
Maybe a Boeing analogy.
So I think as engineers we can tend to fail by you know, chasing after castles in the sky and beautiful designs too far and so on. So we've got to keep that outcome focus, including the economic constraints under which we're operating, which I think was something that you touched on earlier. Yeah. That's got to be part of the picture too. But I think the often the more common commercial led failing is a very naive view of what's cost effective, and building crap fast isn't what's cost effective. Mm-hmm. Building high quality software is the cheaper, faster route.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess kind of coming back to like the system that people find themselves in, which is kind of where I was going with like the kind of geographical comparison, is that, you know, it seems like at a certain point, you know, often these things will start with, you know, someone who's passionate about improving, right? Yes. And often they'll maybe get the opportunity, you know, to do something great, and they'll do a talk about it, and then, you know, kind of maybe it kind of comes up against someone who's saying like, you spent how many developer hours doing this? What value did that produce? Which is, and it's like, of course it produced value, but maybe at the kind of higher levels of this, one of the very important skills is being able to articulate that value and like really make it a business value. And so like I listen a lot to Abby Noda's podcast, where he interviews a bunch of, you know, people in developer experience platform teams.
Yeah.
And it seems like the kind of common theme is typically they will usually frame it around reduction in waste, you know, so sort of time saved, you know, as a dollar value.
Yes, I would use the same argument. You know, I think that continuous delivery works because it's an informal adoption of the scientific method to solving problems in software, and it's built on lean principles of you know, least amount of work for maximum output, and though that combination of things ends up with the most efficient way of working, is my belief.
I was going to say, it puts me in mind of that Martin Fowler's article about, you know, is quality worth it? I recently kind of, with his kind of blessing, kind of adapted that to a games industry focused one. So I basically took his article and kind of changed the examples to be games related. Just because, you know, sometimes, you know, we can't really hear stuff unless it's framed in our own industry. But the point he makes in that is that, which I see a lot, is that we often tend to make it a moral argument. You know, it's like, well, we should do the right thing. We should do the good quality. And he's that says you can't do that. You have to make an economic argument.
I would agree with that entirely. I don't really care about it as a moral argument. If it was better to build crap fast, I'd probably say that's probably the right thing to do. But I just don't think it is. I think it's a commercial argument. It's an engineering argument because the economic constraints in which we operate is part of engineering. You know, you build products in any engineering discipline, bridges or cars or whatever else, you build them within a price constraint. You know, you build them, you know, within the economic constraints of what you're trying to do. And that's part of what we do too, it seems to me.
Yeah. I guess in terms of that messaging, you know, like if you only talk to other engineers, you know, you all implicitly understand, you know, the why you're doing this. You might not have top of mind, you know, the kind of financial benefits. And then it can, I think, easily slip into just kind of not really thinking about it and just saying, well, yeah, this is the right thing to do, or you know, this is good and that's bad. But then when the instant that comes into contact with the business layer, like, then it doesn't go well.
Yeah. So I guess what we've been talking about for the last 5 or 10 minutes of our conversation is I think the last of your list of things from the presentation that I started out with, which is support from leadership. And this is a cultural change that goes way beyond just the technicalities of writing automated tests or building a deployment pipeline. This is a fundamental change in the way in which we organize ourselves to create software.
Yes. And actually, it reminds me of something that you said earlier about, you know, well, actually, it's easy, this stuff, you know, like it's not rocket science. And I didn't mention that, but I meant to say at the time, like, I totally agree with you, you know, actually, but I think it's like, that messaging doesn't go down well often with folks, because they're like, well, it's not easy for me, you know, so we probably have a lot of expert bias, right? We're like, well, yeah, I can, you know, it's obviously you do this, 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 and this, and it's super easy. But yeah, it's like, I guess maybe to the point about support from leadership. Yeah. Like if you don't have that support from leadership, they can absolutely, you know, kill your project, you know, immediately.
I definitely agree, and I am a victim of being too forthright, I suppose sometimes in the way that I express things. I certainly didn't mean to belittle the difficulty for the reasons that we're talking about. It's fine, but it's the social construct in which we operate, and in order to, and that stuff's definitely not easy. Mm-hmm. You know, changing people's minds is hard.
Absolutely, yeah. I didn't mean to, you know, say that.
No, kind of, it's fine.
But yeah, it was on my mind earlier today, actually. I was thinking, you know, it's such a hard conversation to have with people, especially when you're coming from a context where you know that it can work, you've seen it work several times, you know the steps to get there. So yeah, that I always find that a challenge, is to kind of put myself like in the shoes of someone who isn't bought in, and often, you know, can be very defensive about it, right? Like, well, you're saying I'm doing development wrong, you know, I don't have the money for this, I don't have time for this. So it's a challenging and emotive subject.
Yeah. So if you'll forgive me advertising, if you're interested in kind of that part of the problem of how we help to convince people who aren't on side, listen to the podcast with where I talk to Nicole Forsgren, where she talks about that and using data from the Dora metrics and many other techniques for trying to do a better job of those kinds of conversations. Anyway, we're over time. So I'd say thanks once again for taking part. I've really enjoyed the conversation. It's been fascinating, and obviously we're reinforcing one another because we believe a lot of the same things. But it's really interesting to get your different perspective from an industry sector that I haven't worked in. So thanks very much indeed, Henry. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's a great honor, and really enjoyed chatting with you and hearing your perspective on things too.
That's great. Thank you. So to wrap up and to do the social media-y kinds of things, thank you for listening. These discussions are aimed at helping us all to push our discipline forward. If we've helped to change your perspective on the things that we discussed here today, please do leave the podcast a review, as it will help us a lot to reach a wider audience with our show. Also, let us know on Twitter or other social media channels if you've got suggestions for guests that we really should talk to. Similarly, if you have any thoughts on our discussion here today, please do let us know. The best way to get in contact with us is through our Discord, which you can access via Patreon. So if you enjoyed this episode today, please do consider supporting the show, either directly through Patreon or by leaving us a review.